Namaste and in lock catch, and welcome to this episode of One World in a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel, and this week's guest is Christopher Smith. He is a physician, an investor, a blogger. He's a former homeless person, and we'll be talking about that, I'm sure. He's a public speaker. He's an Amazon bestseller with his book, Homeless to Hopkins. And the children's version of it just came out, so you might want to check that out as well. And he's working on a new book called Overcoming Adversity, and you can imagine what that's going to be like just by the title. He's a graduate of Johns Hopkins University and School of Medicine. He's a physician, diagnostic radiologist, and quantum imaging and therapeutic for the Therapeutic Associates. And Christopher, wonderful.
Thank you. We're glad to be here. Thank you.
I hope I did you justice.
It was great. Thank you.
Awesome. So, you know, knowing this, the whole homeless to Hopkins theme, let's start a little earlier than that. And was there anything, as common with my guests, that kind of tuned you into something different as a child? You saw the world a little differently than others around you?
Maybe the fact that I love to read. I love to acquire information. When I was a kid, I would actually read the encyclopedia for fun because I was so curious about the world around me. I literally tried to absorb as much information as possible. And so reading was always kind of my strength. And I loved reading everything. And I was a voracious reader. By the time I was in fifth grade, I was reading like above a 12th grade level because I read so much as a kid. Mm-hmm. And those stories were powerful for me.
So. Oh, no doubt. And especially, you know, and maybe you can help me out with this in your view of kids today. It seems like for some reason they've lost the curiosity of reading. They spend a lot of time in the video realm and cyberspace and playing games and things like that. Do you think, first of all, if you've noticed that there's a shift in that level of curiosity, how do you think, or what would you suggest might be a way of changing that a bit?
I think, well, for me, with my kids growing up, we didn't let them have TVs in the room, but we let them have books. They could have all the books they wanted to read in their room. And so growing up, they would always be reading to go to bed at night instead of watching a YouTube video or anything like that. And I used to take them to Salvation Army or the Goodwill because books are kind of cheap there. So I'd let them go there and they would pick 5 to 10 books, whatever books they wanted, and bring them home. Then when they're done, we'd take them back to the Salvation Army so they could sell them again.
Sure.
And encouraging them to read those books and create their imaginations was kind of key. And I used to also tell them stories rather than like watch videos. Like for bedtime, we would make up stories. Like they would help me make up the stories about you know, to help them go to sleep. So we'd make up these wonderful, amazing stories just having fun.
Sure.
And that was my goal, to encourage them to use their imaginations growing up. And I think as much as we encourage kids, I think the thing with reading is a lot of people don't think they like reading because they haven't found their niche, their genre they like to read. But there are so many genres that are so interesting. And encouraging those people to find those genres, I think will draw them into the world of reading. My daughter actually works at Barnes & Noble now as the bookstore. And she's saying how actually—
Funny coincidence, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So she's seeing a lot more people actually coming in and getting books and things like that for the kids. I think COVID actually might have either encouraged people to read or watch more TV or Netflix or whatever. So mm-hmm. I think just encouraging people to find their niche, the thing they like reading, you know, whether it's fantasy versus, you know, nonfiction, military history, whatever their history is, there are so many books that can interest people. They just need to read them. And once you start reading, you'll be like, wow, this is an amazing world, universe that's opened up to me that I didn't realize was there.
Right. And what's interesting, I think you and I are quite a bit alike in our desire to read and the visual creation that happens in the reading. It's like you go into other worlds. You can actually be there and be absorbed by it, and especially with good writers. And
exactly,
it's really a kind of devastating. As a high school teacher, I was for a while, and that curiosity, the you know, it's hard to instill or inspire when that desire has not really been nurtured in their lives. And by the time kids get to high school, they really, you know, it's hard to develop a curiosity at that point.
Yeah.
So exactly. Now, as you moved forward in your own life and the curiosity that you had, did you begin to explore your inner development, your own self-awareness and how you thought and felt about things and why?
Yeah, so growing up, my life was very turbulent growing up. And so my inner development, actually, as a kid, I had to learn to kind of put those emotions away, kind of box them away, because it was so the circumstance was so difficult, and the fear, and we would move so much. I lost so many friends growing up. You know, I didn't have a friend, and then we'd be moving without any notice. And so I really kind of boxed those feelings a lot inside. Until maybe 10 years ago, I started to kind of unbox that package. And that was actually part of the reason why I decided to write my book, as I was going through these memories and things, trying to come to an understanding of what was happening and why I went through that, and kind of confront those memories, you know, those memories we lock away.
And writing's so cathartic too. The writing is so cathartic. It gives you that opportunity to really self-examine as you're going through those experiences from a little bit of a distance, so that, you know, it's sometimes the sight's a little clearer.
It is. And you remember details. Once you start writing, you remember like little details of events that happen and things and mm-hmm. feelings. The feelings are you get almost like an emotional memory that's there. You don't quite understand why it's there, but it's there in the back of your head, this emotional feeling. And when you're starting to write it down, you're like, okay, yeah, now I understand a little bit more about that emotion that I was feeling and understanding.
Now, do you find that articulating those, and I think this is just a phenomenal point of order in this conversation that's very apocalyptic, because we don't know how to express our emotions. We've never been taught how to interpret the senses that we have. We generally go to emotional responses, right? Which is how we think about how we feel. But the sensation and that feeling is how we are so often ineffable in the moment as children, and we don't really understand how to process it until we get older. How did you find a way to process those things as the compartmentalization that you did? And I understand that, totally normal, right? We kind of push things out that we don't want to have, that just feel bad, first of all. So were there some things that you learned in the unpacking of that over time that helped you to look at the whys and better understand your own process and ability to navigate?
Yes. Actually, my wife is, she's very much in tune with her emotions. She almost has like an empathic type personality where she can understand and feel things and really understand emotions. So my wife has been very instrumental for me, helping me to understand my emotions. She has this energy, this positive energy that kind of helps her to understand people and helps people understand. So you asked me about emotions and be able to kind of come to understand emotions. And my, for me, one person's been very helpful. Number one is, I actually went to therapy for a couple of years. Kind of, if you have a lot of, you know, heavy weight and things like that, sometimes it's good to work it through with somebody who's a professional.
Absolutely.
And so that's one thing I did, and that was actually extremely helpful. But then also my wife has been very helpful for me, because she's more of an emotional person. She's has more of that empathic type personality where she can sense and just feel things about people. It's a unique talent that she has, and be able to like understand their energies, their positive or negative energies, kind of just being able to understand that. And for me, my wife has been very helpful helping me to kind of process emotion and understand emotion, because for her it's intuitive. For me, I have to have logic and try to understand it, because I'm more of the intellectual type.
And
so going through writing my book and going through the process, I started to understand a little lot more about those emotions and how emotions affect me physically and mentally, not just emotionally. And How it's good to actually confront and deal with those emotions. It's okay to cry once in a while. When you feel like you need to cry at something, it's okay to cry. You know, it's taken me a long time to be able to understand that. And
right. It's and as men, we are taught to be stalwart. Don't express, don't cry, don't show emotion. And yet we're so depleted because of that over time, because it's life. We feel just like women do. Shouldn't we be, not that we're shooting on ourselves, right? Yeah. Shouldn't we be able to communicate how we feel and not be reticent of doing so? Of course,
we should be able to.
Appropriately, yeah. Right? We're not going to be screaming and hollering. However, that gets us in touch with how we feel, and it's part of self-awareness, isn't it?
Exactly. Absolutely. And also, one other thing, I agree, it's we need to be more self-aware, especially as men. We kind of bottle those emotions up and now deal with them, which can affect us physically down the long run. They've actually done studies that long-term, you actually affect your physical health if you're not able to work through those emotions. But one other thing that I've also found helpful for me is music. Music for me kind of touches my soul and kind of gives voice to emotions that I can't express verbally, but I can express it, feel through music. I can understand through music.
You play at all?
I didn't have the chance growing up because my life was so chaotic, but all my daughters, they all play a couple instruments, piano, voice, and violin. But just in general, music, listening to music or feeling music, I wish I played. I actually, one of my goals eventually is to learn the guitar here when I get a little time.
Good for you.
But music, I think we all have this universal, music's kind of a universal language.
It is.
And I think part of it is because when we're babies in the womb or the uterus, we hear the heartbeat of our mothers for 9 months straight. And if you look at the beat of music, most popular music, the beat is very similar to a human heartbeat. Mm-hmm. And so I think as we grow up, we hear that. And so music can touch our soul when we can't really express other ways to do it. You know, it's hard to express those emotions, but a lot of time music is able to express and make people feel. And it doesn't matter the language. Like I listen to K-pop now and stuff like that. And I still love it. You know, I like like groups like BTS. And I obviously read the translations, but I can understand. I feel the music and I can just feel it.
My wife is a conservatory trained accompanist and music theory pedagogue from St. Petersburg, Russia.
Okay.
So she's gone through their rigors and is a consummate professional in how she plays. And she understands all of this, you know, music. She says she speaks four languages. One of them is music. And part of what they studied was not just the music. It was the composer. It was the time. It was the tone and voice of the time and the emotions in the music. And so there's this depth of understanding from the sensations of this music. And it takes us all kinds of different places in doing so. So those things are I'm just a drummer, right? So
just a drummer. Drummers are awesome. I love
drummers. Thank you. And I love to play, especially improv and fusion. Progressive rock and jazz kind of stuff, to where, you know, it's just explosive and you just let go and play, and there's this jumping off into the void, not knowing where you're going to go, and yet you often have these wonderful conversations musically by doing so. It's just a phenomenal experience, much the same as what I believe you are saying in just the feeling of the music and where it takes you and how it processes inside you.
Exactly. So when I was a teenager, that was one of my escapes, was to listen to different types of music. Mm-hmm. And all the huge gamut from Broadway musicals all the way to stuff like Metallica, heavy metal, you know, just a huge range, you know, right. Just depends on the mood. So as a kid, you ask about emotions. That's one of the things actually I did to help process my emotions, was listen to music. So.
Now, did you find yourself, when you're listening to music, were you conscious of how the music was taking your, or was aiding and abetting your emotions?
I think it depended on the mood, but yes.
Right. So in that understanding, where did it go? How did you bring that into your experience? And before we go into that, there's this, the process that you went through going from homeless to Hopkins is excruciating and ecstatic, I'm sure. In those excruciating moments, I like to use the term excruciatingly fun because they're not so fun in the moment, but when you're looking back, you can kind of see the silliness sometimes of your behavior and your choices, right? So in that excruciating part, what were kind of some of the things that you were dealing with and the process that you went through internally with that to move forward?
So there were many experiences growing up. Probably one of the most traumatic was my senior year of high school. We were homeless and I slept in a car my entire senior year of high school. And it was in Utah, so it would get cold in winter. It would get quite cold, as in like 20 degrees cold. And sometimes I'd wake up and my hair would actually be frozen. Back when I had more hair, my hair would be frozen and because it was so cold. And sometimes
those days, huh?
We did. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, exactly. We did have hair at one point. So, sometimes when I sleep, I would just hope that I wouldn't wake up. You know, I hope that I would just die in my sleep. You know, just typical. You know, just some of those things that you're struggling with, that depression, that, you know, anxiety, and those were difficult times. And at night, I would just sit there and look at the stars. One of the things I would do, because obviously at night you can look at the stars. And I would think, you know, is there some type of higher power in the universe? Is something there? Is there something greater than this little sphere we kind of, you know, live on? Is there something important? Do I matter to this world? Does the world matter? You know, this is a teen, of course, I was a 16-year-old kid. So these kids have these existential thoughts anyway. But when you're sleeping in a car, you think that much more as a kid. Well,
oh, and they're exponentiated in the depth of the feeling of them, especially in the situation you were in.
Yeah, and so it was very difficult. So I one night I remember I was thinking, you know, this life's really not very good. But then I just came to this realization that there is some higher power in the universe. And whether or not, you know, you're religious or not, but I think the idea of having this spirituality, the sense of a greater good, that you're connected to the universe, that you're not just a sole individual, that we're all interconnected, this idea of kind of the spirituality. And that kind of feeling helped me to get through those difficult times, that there is some good or positivity in the world. And so with that, when I was 19, I actually went and served a religious mission in California, down in the barrios, the Latino parts in Southern California. Some of those neighborhoods are pretty rough. I actually saw a couple drive-by shootings firsthand, as in like 20 feet away, 50 feet away. But the people in those areas, talk about interconnection, those people, they're so humble and so pure, but they're so giving, so willing to share. And they don't have much, but they're willing to share with others. Mm-hmm. And they would give us their food. I mean, they didn't have much food, but they would invite us in for meals and have dinner with us, and just the kindness. And that changed my whole perception of the world, that I started to realize that there's a lot of good in the world, that there's a lot of positivity. Right. And because
if I may offer, they recognized you as a more of a stalwart individual because you were on a mission and you were recognizably so.
Exactly, white shirt and tie. And we actually talked to gang members, you know, they're about pretty close to our age. We'd go talk to them and be in these rough neighborhoods where actually we have police officers stop and say, hey, do you guys know where you are? You know, this is not like the best neighborhood for you to be in. We're like, oh yeah, we're okay. And because the people there they're just tremendous, the goodness. And it changed my perception from the victim mentality, which I'd been raised in, because I was raised and taught to be afraid of everything and everybody in the world, this fear that everybody was out to get you, that there's no good in the world. That's what I was raised as. Hmm. But this experience changed me in the fact that then I was able to say, okay, yeah, they're actually really amazing, wonderful, great people in this world.
This world can be at least expected.
Exactly. And those people, they live in these really very difficult, but they're still these amazing, wonderful people where you don't expect it. And it changed my whole perception of life. So I did a 180-degree flip, and I realized that there is so much good in this world, so much positivity, so much positive energy, that to try to focus on that to help me overcome, to be able to keep going, to go back and go to college and go to medical school. And that just propelled me forward. It changed everything. And I think once we start to have that positive positivity in the world, we start to get some positive feedback or just send positive energy out in the world, that it affects not just us, but everybody around us.
Absolutely. You know, I, not to go metaphysical on you or anything, but there was a woman that I'd met that was trained in the Huna way, which is Hawaiian shamanism. And she was speaking at a church up in Prescott in a, about a 40-foot square room and hadn't been set up yet. I went early to talk with her because I was curious, and understanding that her workshop is about demonstrating the size of our aura in the past, present, and future, and how that affects us. Well, I was curious. I was like, okay, all this energy stuff. Well, she used dowsing rods, and she gave me a quick demonstration. She said, okay, I want you to, I'm standing in one corner of the room, and she said, I want you to go into the past, close your eyes and go into the past and just feel an event and go there with every ounce of your being. And I'm going to go over the other corner of the room and I'm going to clear the rods. I'm going to walk towards you and I'm going to stop where they open. And I'm going to mark the spot. And then I'm going to go back and I'm going to do something. We're going to look in the future and do the same thing. And then we're going to go into the present moment and show you the difference. And I said, okay. So bottom line, the past and the future opened up in almost the same spot, about 6 feet away. The present, she barely got two steps in from the other side of the room.
Interesting.
And it was a phenomenal realization that even when we don't meditate or we don't focus, we're not, you know, really trying to be centered and present, that just that movement into it for a moment expands our energy that much more, and which makes us two things: more available to others, and that others can actually feel us too, and that we can change that environment simply by how we think and feel without saying a word.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, like I can tell when I walk in a room, you can walk, sometimes you can tell when you walk in a room, someone's just like very positive, positive energy, positive. Or you walk in the opposite, you feel like it's just negative, like something's just, you know, just like a vortex of negativity.
Yeah, it's almost, in some places I felt like I got hit in the stomach with a sledgehammer. That was that forceful, I don't want to say ego, because it's not a bad thing. It was that force of will and the pushing of the energy to do that, that we feel at that level, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And so when I was a kid and growing up, that whole energy, the whole, my perspective on life changed 180 degrees. Mm-hmm. And it helped me to be able to deal with those difficult times. And reading also, we talked about reading, but reading inspired me. When I was a kid, I would read books about these amazing people, even though they're fictional characters. For example, I love the Lord of the Rings. Gandalf and Aragorn were kind of right. My heroes growing up. And so they overcame these insurmountable odds. Obviously, it's a fiction story, but it just kind of inspired me as a kid, saying, okay, here are these people, even people like Abraham Lincoln, who grew up in a log cabin, became president of the United States. You know, these people kind of inspired me as a kid to be able to dream of something bigger, you know, something larger. And though that also helped me, kind of inspired me to get.
Why do you think that we as a population, and I'm surmising this just based on what I think I see around me and the perceptions from that, what's keeping us from living larger in our own lives?
I think a lot of times it's us. I think we are sometimes our own, we keep ourselves back. We hold ourselves back a lot. I think we have this fear of, I think a lot of times we have this fear of failure, fear of putting ourselves out there. And so we don't. And by doing so, then we do fail. We set ourselves up to fail.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times we're our own worst enemies, basically. We hold ourselves back. Because I think you see these amazing people who achieved incredible things, like someone like Oprah Winfrey. You know, she grew up incredibly poor, and now she's this multi-billionaire. Mm-hmm. Person has affected thousands and thousands of lives for a positive way, because right. She wasn't afraid. She kept taking those risks and kept moving forward.
Ted Turner's another one, didn't graduate, you know, quit school at eighth grade, you know, and then developed this huge network.
Yeah.
Fascinating people, yourself included, as to, for two reasons. One, that first of all, you and I'm going to go out on a limb, you would choose to live this kind of life in order to learn what you did, right? And I'm not saying that that's a choice that you consciously made. However, it was one that you set yourself up before coming here to do in order to get where you are. The other is that learning process and the growth, the understanding, the connectedness. And you mentioned spirituality. This is that sense that we're all connected, right? And to be able to come from that place and the experience that you had sounds like it really anchored that at least next level of experience of it in your life. So where did that take you from there? How did you bring that into your own experience and after you served your mission, and where did you go with that?
So after I served my mission, I came back. So before my mission, I actually had a scholarship, but then I lost my scholarship my first year of college because I was working full-time. I took like 17, 18 credits a semester, which is really difficult to do. And I lost it by 0.05. So in order to maintain the scholarship, you had to have a 3.5 GPA. I ended up with a 3.45 GPA for the year. So I lost it just by that much. Yeah. So when I got back from school, I was like, so I became back with this renewed purpose. That's the renewed sense of energy. And I came back and I enrolled in school. This time I had to pay for it with grants and working and student loans. And then I met my wife, right? Shortly after I got back, I met she was my future wife at that time. So I met her and then I just felt complete. I felt like part of me, once I met my wife and started to have that relationship, I felt like I had somebody who could love me unconditionally for me to be able to fill that emptiness that I always had in my heart.
Isn't that a great feeling? And it's unfortunate that it seems rare that that kind of combination, and at least from what I'm seeing, that in adults, there's that reticence to be really fully intimate and vulnerable with each other. And you can sense that there was a whole withholding of energy that could be present that isn't.
Yes, I completely agree. And the idea of being vulnerable and being kind of sharing who you truly are, your struggles, that's difficult to do.
That's a scary thing to do.
It is very scary.
Right?
It is, because then you like strip away all the facade and you see you actually who you truly are, all your flaws and all your strengths, you know, just who you are.
Sure.
But I think that's important to have that though, in order to truly be connected with somebody or people in general.
You would be inauthentic if you didn't, right? There's this authenticity of being raw and real. However that is, you have to be able to love yourself enough to be able to experience that and not push it away. You know, there's an interesting thing that I found, and probably one of the reasons why I was led into the church for a while I had an experience as a teen that was very similar to Mr. Smith's, and that's not for the Matrix Mr. Smith, although he's it could be. So what I found through that, I actually prayed to know what truth was. I was willing to die for it. I was in my first year of college, and it was just distraught, kind of like you were. And just wanted to know. And I want to know truth. I was willing to die for it if necessary. Well, why not? Right? Isn't it worth dying for? And of course, afterwards, there was this understanding that, you know, there really is no death, and that we're all this infinite intelligence condensed into form in our individuated ways with a purpose once we're willing to start asking what that is. Most of us, let me ask this, did you feel like you were moved by others to do what you're doing, or was it an internal direction, force, inspiration that you had to do so?
I think it was a combination of both, but I did definitely have this internal inspiration or guidance. When I look at my life, the odds of this are so stratospheric that I would go from sleeping in a truck to being a physician at Johns Hopkins are so stratospherically high that there's no way possible that happened randomly. It's my own number, my own
many gestalt. Serendipitous and synchronistic moments in that.
Exactly. Exactly. There are many, many, many small moments that added together to create this thing, and many small choices and work along the way.
Now, that's an interesting point right there that you just made, and pardon me for interrupting, but this is really serious. The many small choices, right? That some schools of thought think that, you know, you have to make this big grandiose choice and then everything else falls into it. And yes, from that perspective of, you know, have the end in mind first and then back it up, right? That's the standard business entrepreneurial philosophy. And yet there's this other part of you that's what you're seeking is seeking you too. And there's an openness, a vulnerability, and the ability to be curious as to what that might be that then seems to kind of nudge us in the right direction when we are paying attention.
Yes, exactly. And a couple things I did. When I was a kid, I did bungee jumping just for fun, just tried it. And I think that's kind of a lot like life. You know, when you're up on this little platform and you're looking down, you know there's this little rope that's holding you, and you have to trust in that rope. As soon as you lean over and let go, it's out of your control. But you have to make the effort to lean forward and let go, and then that rope pulls you back up and propels you forward. And I think that's
so what's it like at the bottom of that before you're pulled back out?
So right before you're pulled back, your first time you're thinking, oh my, what am I doing? What did I just do? You know, am I going to hit on the ground and just, you know, your life flashes before your eyes. But then the moment that that rope catches and you start to be lifted back up, it's an ecstatic feeling. It's like you're floating on a cloud. It's like you just kind of hit and then you're just floating back up. And it's just such an amazing, wonderful feeling. And that's why I think people do that. They have that mix of adrenaline of the fight and flight, you know, while they're falling, and then this lifting experience.
Now, do you feel or do you believe that sensation, because once we experience something, we got a file, right? There's a file that contains it. Do you believe that we can call that file up by choice and re-experience that as in place of, for instance, something that we're going through where that situation just kind of wipes us out and puts us in that depressive mode? Is there a potential for making a choice and tying into that sensation to bring it present?
I think there absolutely is. I think those experiences create emotional memories, not just physical, but emotional memories. Our bodies have this emotional memory. And when we think back of our experiences, when we think back experience we went through, we often recall the emotion associated with that experience. Mm. And I think at times when we're struggling, we can bring back some of those positive emotions to kind of give us some positive energy. But I also think that sometimes we also have triggers sometimes that put us back into the negative emotional memories of our lives. Sure. And being able to filter that out and kind of come back to the present, kind of partially with mindfulness, I think that's one thing with mindfulness that does. And actually, that's one thing I actually started doing over the past 5 to 10 years is practicing this mindfulness and being able to focus on the present and letting all that stuff go. Mm-hmm. Was very helpful. Being able to kind of filter those emotions, bring back the positive ones, like you said, recall the positive and try to let the negative ones just pass through me and go back, you know, just go on.
Sure. Now you mentioned mindfulness. Is this a practice of being more quiet and still in the moment and just observing what's happening and not being engaged by it, and then being able to kind of hit the pause button and it's like choosing how you want to engage it, if you even.
I think that's part of it, but also I think just taking time daily to be present. Like I try to take time, like at least five minutes a day, kind of just sitting down quietly and just thinking, okay, what am I feeling? What am I smelling? What am I hearing? You know, mm-hmm. What am I tasting? Just taking a moment to be present, mindfulness, and letting whatever thoughts come into my mind come and go, kind of like watching cars pass along your freeway. Kind of, because I think the thing people mess up like with mindfulness and meditation is they want to try to control their thoughts. But in reality, you just kind of have to relax and just let the things come, let it come.
The more
and
you try to control, the more you're gonna, the more you fight, the more you resist, the more it persists. We all know this, right?
So yeah, exactly.
The practice of it, it's like, gosh, why do we do that? Well, I don't know, but we do. And so, or and we do. So, how does this how would it be able to then help one to transcend the agony of moments in being or feeling stifled by anything?
So for me growing up, I had a lot of traumatic experiences. We're evicted so many times, I can't even count, at least 20 plus 25 times. Mm-hmm. And usually the police or whomever would come, put the thing on the door and evict us out of the house, or the landlord or whatever. So one of the triggers for me growing up was when I would see a siren or a police, I would have like almost like a panic attack. I would have this anxiety, you know, just because this emotional memory was there versus nothing was happening in the moment completely, you know, nothing positive, you know, just like even like an ambulance driving past on the road, whatever it was just kind of had this emotional memory. And so what I learned to do is kind of filter that, say, okay, yes, those things happened in the past, but nothing's happening now. Everything's fine now. The idea of being able to focus on the present, who I am, and just letting that go, letting that emotion go. And you talked about how men, we bottle those things up. And as men, one thing we have to learn to do is those emotions from the past, emotional memories, is we need to uncover those and face them and let them go. Because if we don't, they'll still be there.
Well, and an empathic and understanding wife certainly helps that process, right? Because we carry that stuff. And I've noticed it in my own relationship, that there were things that I'd, you know, that would come up. Of course, we had different cultures that we were brought up in, which was in and of itself an interesting amalgamation of, you know, thoughts and feelings and beliefs and things of that nature. And then there was this ability to just look at ourselves and not be afraid that we would be rejected, you know, regardless. And some stuff comes out, it can get pretty ugly, because you're processing the emotions in the moment, and that often, especially if they've been stuffed for a while, it's going to come out and not feel too good to anybody, right? Yeah. And yet there's that unconditional or the understanding that, yeah, this isn't about me or about you. This is about the process and the trigger that's being examined, I guess, in that moment and worked through, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. In my book, I kind of talk about wounds and scars. So a lot, we all go through this life. We all end up with wounds. We all end up with emotional, physical, mental wounds as we go through life. That's just part of it. You can't avoid it. But once we kind of confront those wounds and we're able to work through them, then they become scars that are strong, that can be like strong, that can help strengthen us through those future difficult times and help others. Mm-hmm. And as we share our own scars, our own wounds with others and lift them, then our scars almost become like a badge of honor. You know, these things that we overcame these demons or these things that we overcame, that we can help others then overcome their own difficulties. And by sharing, the past becomes a lot less painful, then it actually kind of has a purpose. It gets a purpose. Those experiences we've gone through, we can have a purpose in sharing them with others to help them work through their own experiences. Mm-hmm. And it kind of keeps us interconnected, like we're talking about. As we share and become vulnerable, we're able to connect with others and be able to help them work through whatever difficulties they're going through.
And do you find that in doing so, that energy, because there's attachment to that, even though we work on letting it go, there over time there's still minor attachments to it that do flare up. And do you find that in the process of talking about it and discussing, you know, with others to help them, that it also is more of a release of that energy within you too, and gives the opportunity to view it and assess and grow with and use as a teaching tool, perhaps?
Absolutely. I actually, one thing I do now is I actually speak at fundraisers to raise money for homelessness, to raise awareness of homelessness. Mm-hmm. And when I share these fundraisers, like I just spoke a couple weekends ago, the Palm Beach Mayor's Ball, which is in Palm Beach County, Florida, for the Homeless Coalition in Palm Beach County. And I spoke and kind of shared my experiences growing up. Afterwards, I had several people go up and say, thank you so much. You brought back some memories I had as a, you know, that I went through as a kid. And it really touched me and helped me to kind of see things in a different perspective. And I actually, my older siblings, as my book has been coming out, I shared with some of them and they read it and they're like, thank you so much. We've never ever talked about this growing up. We never talked about our lives growing up. And I was able to sit down and talk to my older brother and sister as, you know, kind of, and he said, my older brother said, this is so therapeutic to be able to just talk about this, to get it out, you know, and to have that connection with him, that shared emotion. And it really helped him just talking about it, helped me. And at the same time, as we talked about it, helped me. And you talked about writing is cathartic, writing this book, processing all those emotions, sharing them with everybody, being vulnerable. Cause you know, in my book, there are some pretty vulnerable moments that I share with the world. Mm-hmm. And being able to be, you know, I'm putting it out there just so I can help everybody else. And as I did that, those experiences, you know, the release happens. You're not afraid anymore. That fear that you hold back kind of goes away and you kind of walk through it and you realize it's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. And it is. Now, one of the things that came to mind as you were talking about that, you know, there's a variance of perception and how we're received by others. For instance, we were talking earlier about the college experiences and what we went through and my awakening or the experience that I had. And after I had it, my parents, I told them about it. I was pretty open and vocal because I thought it was pretty cool, but I wasn't looking at it from a place of mental disturbance, right? I wasn't trying to categorize or label it on a DSM level of any kind, right? Because it was real and it felt semi-normal, I guess. It's just part of the process. And I wasn't wacky over it. I was just trying to figure it out and understand it. So the psychiatrist they sent me to after a few visits said, you know, you're not crazy. You've had a spiritual awakening. Why so young? Don't understand it. Most people don't go through it till the mid-40s, if they ever do. And then explained that, you know, with what I knew or understood, that I better not talk to others about it because there would be no understanding, let alone listening to it. And I'm a big mouth, so I didn't pay attention. The following year, I got accosted at a frat house one night looking for a warm spot and ended up in the hospital, and my parents decided to commit me. And they were concerned because I was on the edge. I made a stupid decision. I bought a couple of sets of drums and put them in my dorm room, spent half my room and board money, which meant I had to move out during the winter break. And I was too full of myself to tell them. And so I thought I would be able to make it, you know, make it through and fine. And I did in some way. However, when dad came to pick, you know, I thought he was coming to pick me up and he said, no, I think you need to stay. And I think, okay, blow to the head, possible concussion, overnight observation. Yeah, I'm cool with that. Then a couple of orderlies walk up, take me onto the elevator, escort me up to the 7th floor. Door opens up. There's a huge black guy with a lot of keys on his belt that stands up from a chair and says, oh, got another one for me, huh? And at that point, I realized what was happening. Now, what happened was that in my discussions with the hospital psychologist, he was very clinical and labeled me from the DSM-4 at the time as a manic, depressive, paranoid, schizophrenic, and put me on 2,000 micrograms of Thorazine a day. And so that's the complete opposite of what ought to have happened, and not, you know, trying to understand the individual instead of treat it as a disease or a syndrome or you know, trying to put them in a box again, which is how it felt. And yet I was so vehement in my own experience that the Thorazine had no effect. I was up playing ping pong and beating the male nurses. I should not have been able to do that.
Yeah, right? Not with that much Thorazine. Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so they didn't understand what was going. I didn't know any better, right? I didn't know the effect it was supposed to have. What it did teach me, though, is to stick to my truth, even though afterwards I would shake on the inside so bad that my body would tremble in talking about things with others because I was scared to death of being put back in an institution. And it's funny that I think my dad was 80 when he finally shared this with me. He says, you know, he called me Brucey still, which is my given name. And he says, you know, I was really afraid that when you moved to Phoenix that you would say something in the wrong place and they would take you away. And I said, well, Dad, I've been there for 35 years. I think I made it. So, and evidently the screen did too. That was a nice little
flash.
Now, that's interesting. Was that specifically timed? Were the friendlies apparent, or, you know, was it just a glitch? Who knows?
Yeah.
Interesting timing. However, those kinds of things are evidence of how we do not pay attention to the individual and ask them questions. We assume certain things and then treat them accordingly.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't listen with the intent to listen. We listen with some other motive, such as the advice or whatever. We don't just listen to understand. And listening and understand, I think, is a great skill, and it's a difficult skill to just be in the presence and listen to someone and try to truly understand their perspective and their point of view.
It's a discipline, because you want to, you know, we want to speak, especially when something, it's like loose association, right? For folks on the spectrum, if you will, that there are these triggers. You hear something and you automatically got to respond, right? There's just no controlling it. And yet in that place, you learn how to discipline yourself to just be quiet and still and wait for a moment that then appears for you to speak. And that's the interesting thing about it. It's like, what is the third insight in James Redfield's Celestine Prophecy? I don't know if you ever read that or not. It speaks to that listening and not speaking until you feel it well up from within you. And that's a much different feeling than coming from here.
Exactly. Yes. Listening to understand, listening to emotionally connect with someone to truly try to feel what they're feeling. That's what one thing my wife's kind of taught me, this empathic, these skills. And I'm getting better at it. Obviously, I'm not as good as she is, but I'm getting better at learning to just listen and try to understand and feel what the person I'm talking to is feeling, you know?
And now we have a word for that, or two words actually, emotional intelligence. And it applies in relationships as well as corporate environments now. And that is a huge growth in how we at least understand the impact of it, not necessarily what we do about it, because we're still struggling in how to be in that place with each other. Do you find that to be true?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I find also, as you share and have the emotional connection, you almost feel like friends or family, you know, when you talk to these people and you have this emotional connection. You feel this inner, like we talked about, the interconnection of the universe. You feel connected in some ways or another. And I think people have used that connection, emotional intelligence, for good and for bad. If you look in history, you know, people have used it to manipulate others, but also other people use it to lift others and create, you know, positivity. You know, somebody, for example, like Gandhi, who used that kind of positivity to inspire, you know, change in his country for the good. You know, then sure. You have other people in history who did the opposite. I don't really talk about them, but so that emotional connection and just feeling with people can be a very powerful force for good and the opposite.
Do you see the world coming out of COVID, speaking of positive change for the world? It was hoped for, a belief, maybe in a possibility in the beginning. I know when we went on lockdown here, I turned to my wife and I said that, you know, I really hope that this obsession on self-hygiene and sequestration would get people to turn inward and questioning who they are, right? And getting closer to themselves. And that then was hoped that would create a wave of change coming out of it that gives us a more empowered, conversant, connected world. And of course, that's going to take some time. Do you see that as a silver lining coming out of COVID?
I think, yes, for some people, I think it is a silver lining. I think for other people, they actually became more disconnected, unfortunately. They turned to other ways to pass the time, like Netflix or whatever, kind of more the impersonal type way. And I think, but I have found a lot of people actually did, there are quite a few people now, I think, have this connection now. Because now I think people would use Zoom and things like that to talk to people. And you know, all these new technologies that help people to remain connected, I think is a positive way to connect. Not just such as like the YouTube videos, but actually connect, like such as a Zoom video call or things. Right. I think that technology.
Like what we're doing here.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
We're getting into some deep areas that few explore. And I think it's more important to explore this real raw reality that we're not quite sure about and yet have some ideas, that have an open environment in order to share and speculate and you know, maybe even have an apocalyptic moment where an aha happens and this knowledge that's been there the entire time suddenly comes to the surface. Because that's really what the name or what the word apocalypse means. It's uncovering. It's not the end of the world.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, for you mentioned that, for me, that actually happened probably 8-10 years ago. I was struggling with some you know, just my past, kind of working through and just struggling and feeling a lot of kind of anxiety and stuff. And then my wife one night came to me and said, "Hey, have you ever read the book by Viktor Frankl, you know, Man's Search for And so she said, "I think you should read this." And I started reading, and I read the idea that basically as you learn to deal with your past and share it, it becomes less painful. Mm-hmm. And kind of the idea that, and that was kind of my aha apocalyptic moment, you could say, you know, just kind of like realization that, you know, I needed to kind of work through this and share, start to share with people, you know, kind of these feelings and emotions to help them, not just for me, but to help them to share it out there. And that was part of the reason why at that point, that's when I kind of started working on my book, kind of revisit the past and go through that. And that was kind of my aha moment.
There's two ways of doing that, at least, right? There's the sharing in order to be helpful, understanding, connect with another. And then there's the victim that likes to play on the emotions and things like that. This is one of the things that I think it is important that we get to that place where we recognize that we have the choice and have made those choices for every experience that we've had. And it's time that we take responsibility and accountability for that. Only when we do that, that's where the self-love really begins, in embracing who we are without condition and just saying, okay, this is what I did. And these were, you know, understanding. That's where the unpacking, the catharsis comes, easy for me to say, in the writing as you're processing, which few of us actually do. You know, there's this, the journaling notion that, I mean, there was so much about that not that long ago as far as the opportunity to process things through journaling and being able to grow from that. In the process of writing your book, did you do a lot of journaling in those years in college and post-college before taking on the writing?
I would do it intermittently. I wish I would have done it more.
What kinds of things did you write about? What was most important to jot down in those moments, do you think?
When I was a kid, I think I tend to intellectualize things, so I couldn't deal with the emotion. And so when I wrote, I kind of just wrote events and things that were happening. But when I wrote events, those emotions, see, I have a very good memory. And so those emotions and memories are still there. And so once I start thinking about the events, then the emotions come back. You know, once those events that I wrote about, things happening, not just, so then I remember the feelings, not just the event, but the feelings associated with that. And I think that's helpful by journaling. Journaling is a great tool, as it helps us to put words to our feelings and our emotions. It helps us to understand them.
Therapeutic too, with a major degree, it's the choice to be able to, you know, carve out the time and actually do it. Are there other things that you had something to say?
So I'm saying, yeah, your idea of accountability and choice and choosing, that's one thing that I realized, like I said on my mission, that we had power to choose, that I wasn't a victim, that the world was not controlling me, but I could make choices. I may not be able to choose my circumstances where I start, but I could make choices that then change my future circumstances.
Absolutely.
That I was empowered to do that.
Now, how do you recommend that is found inside and developed? How do we access that? How do we get a framework to apply that in? Because again, we're not necessarily taught about how to process and engage and feel all these things and be able to articulate that process too.
Yeah, it can be difficult because I said that we're afraid. See, I think we're afraid of being accountable, saying, you know, yes, I made that choice. It was a bad choice. We have to be accountable to ourselves and be honest. I think things, we have to be honest with ourselves, you know, and accept ourselves. Yes, you made a choice, bad choice then, but you don't have to make that choice again. You can change that choice and make a different choice in the future. Mm-hmm. And the idea that I think it starts with just small choices, realizing when I wake up, I can choose to go to work and do what I need to do, and or I can try to, you know, I can, or I can do the opposite and not do what I'm supposed to do. But we have to realize just those little small choices each day then start to change that whole mindset that mm-hmm. we make those small choices that we are empowered.
Now, speak in that empowered place, when you're in process of making that choice, I assert that there's a certain sense, there's a knowing, there's a, this is the right thing to do, right? That's unquestionable.
And yeah, the inner.
And yet we often don't do that.
Exactly. I think we all have that inner voice or that conscience, you could say, that kind of right. tells, you know, this is a good thing to do, this is a bad thing to do. And sometimes we do the good thing, sometimes we don't. And so, and I think learning to listen to that voice and being there and say, okay, how does this make me feel what I'm doing? Is this making me feel better? You know, meaning in a positive way versus a negative way. Mm-hmm. And being honest with ourselves, saying, you know, yes, you can make this choice, but it's entirely up to you. You have the agency to choose. And it's those little choices that add up over years to where we end up in our future.
Right. You know, one of the things I look for is the common threads throughout all of the schools of thought, religions, things of that nature. And one of the things, I had the wonderful opportunity of getting to know a gentleman named Kai D. And if you don't recognize the name, he was the original WOFAT on Hawaii 5.0. Years
oh, ago. Okay.
And he actually had a doctorate in theology and was the rector for Taoist Sanctuary here in Tempe, Arizona. He was one of my early interviews on the show that I did in the early 90s called One World, which is kind of where this came off a 30-year hiatus to do this. He had said to me during an interview that, you know, in their way, the Taoist way, things are either desirable or undesirable. And that's at a very base feeling level. You know, how can we, what do you recommend, or how can we pay more attention to that, bring it up in ourselves, act upon that in the positive way, and talk about the process? Because this is where that the next level of catharsism comes, in my opinion, is that as we share these things in a more communal way, then that affects the larger perspective, the larger population as well, because we're being more free and open and transparent and loving in the process. Gosh, imagine that, more loving.
Yeah, and I think we also learn to have self-love. I think I think many people with their lives, they don't love themselves. They're actually very judgmental and harsh on their self, on themselves, more so than the world.
You can imagine what an adoptee, okay, once an orphan at birth, adoptee, you find out very young you're adopted. What's the first thing you're going to think about? How self-deprecating you can be towards yourself because somebody else didn't want you. Your mother and father did not want you. That's what a little child thinks.
Yeah.
And so some of those kinds of things take decades to get over because you don't even realize that that's where your baseline emotions are. Is this, you know, abandonment, rejection. And so you create it in your life.
Yeah.
And you go, wait a minute, something's not right here. And you realize, oh, okay, it's about me. It's not about anybody else.
Yeah, and you think about a good point is when you're going through that, you have to realize that you're accountable. You're accountable for your choices, mm-hmm. how those choices affect others, whether they're good or negative. You still are accountable for those choices. You're accountable for your actions.
Now, and even in those environments, sorry to interrupt, because I had a really wonderful childhood, just exquisite, and yet there were still those patterns because of that emotional detachment early on that I couldn't process until much later.
But yeah, and that almost
never a question about the unconditional love my parents had.
Yeah, and that emotional detachment is kind of how I wasn't adopted, obviously, but you kind of pack those emotions away in a box and stick them somewhere, and you don't confront them for 10, 20, 30 years, you know. And but eventually, once you open that box, you kind of work through it, you realize you come to an understanding a lot more so of those emotions and feelings of the past, and you can leave it behind. You know, that's the thing is.
Do you find that it produces, in leaving it behind, do you find that it produces a sense of fearlessness?
You do, yeah. I think the fear goes away a lot more so, because then you realize, yes, I had those feelings, but that's still part of me, but that's okay. You know, that's okay that I felt that angst or that anger as a teenager. You know, I felt that, but and that's okay. It's part of who I am. You don't have to run from it. I kind of like this idea of like you run from your past, but once you learn to embrace it, you know, that's part of who you are. That's part of who you are too. You know, you're right. Not this person today. You're from the past as well. And accepting yourself. And that's where I think kind of that self-love being okay. You know, yes, I have some issues, you know, kind of like the idea of the Japanese art where they fix pottery with gold, you know, broken pottery, you know, yes, I have those flaws, those that I was broken, but that's okay. That means that I've lived life, that I've overcome these difficult circumstances. And now I'm a beautiful pot made out of, you know, my fractures are made out of gold now, you know, kind of like the old idea of the Japanese.
Right. Now, speaking of fractures, I'm going to jump into the quantum imaging, the work that you do. We're going to go a little different direction here and get a little more, perhaps. I mean, we've been talking, it's been a wonderful excursion into the spiritual, the connectedness, the processing and the real and rawness that you've expressed. And I truly appreciate that. On more the science side of things, and I'm not sure, so this may be a question that doesn't belong. In the quantum imaging, are you looking, let me just ask you this, what do you look for in the quantum imaging? And are you beginning to look at other indicators as to what might be present in an individual that's out of alignment?
So with our group, we use imaging to obviously diagnose disease. I'm a diagnostic radiologist, and also not just disease, but other things that are happening with people. And what's interesting in the field itself is you're starting to see more things called PET imaging, which is positron emission tomography, and the MRI imaging, like a functional MRI imaging. And it's fascinating because functional MRI specifically, or PET, is what it is. For PET imaging, they actually administer certain radioactive material that gets taken up by certain parts of the brain. And as people go through certain things, or like, for example, Alzheimer's or dementia, they're starting to find areas of the brain that they didn't understand before, and kind of the functionality of these changes in the brain over time that people experience as they have disease. And then other things, though, like the functional MRI is fascinating because the last people questions and things like that in the MRI, and different parts of their brain light up and kind of, it's not really what they expect, and the patterns are really not what they expect. And there's so much fascinating activity that happens in the brain as they go through this.
What do you think they have the expectations? Is there an idea that they presume how the brain functions, and so their expectations as to where they're going to see this firing taking
place? So, yeah, I think they're scientists, so they approach it scientifically. I mean, they have this theory, this hypothesis that this part of the brain must do this versus that based on the anatomy, but the physiology is not always the same as the anatomy, it's the way it works. And the interconnection, the brain has so many interconnected neurons that we're not even beginning to understand at the depths of how, you know, how the brain functions, and not just the brain, but in connection with our own, the eternal side of us or the spiritual side of us, you know, because we have our physical, but then we have the two are connected together.
Sure. And speaking of the two, let's go to the right and left hemispheres. What I find interesting that I don't see much about yet, there's indicators throughout the historical literature, the chakra system in specific, the pineal and the hypothalamus, right? Being two of those organs that are the third eye and the throat chakra, I think is what they're associated with. So what I find interesting, apparently, and correct me if I'm wrong, the pineal is at the top of the corpus callosum and the hypothalamus is at the bottom. And the corpus callosum is the membrane in between the two hemispheres.
It connects the two, yeah.
Right. So this is where the two communicate through. Now, is it possible that when you have that energy flowing in more dynamic ways, you're open, you're looking for connectedness, you're maybe even thinking that the chakra system is somehow at play in your body, and you want to open that up to be more sensitive. Could it be that in doing so, that that energy, the flow, then dissipates into both hemispheres through the corpus callosum, and then brings a maybe even a higher level of functionality in the world based on the connectedness?
Yeah, so I think when we're disconnected, I think as we're able to form those connections between our right and left, or between like the emotional and the intellectual side, mm-hmm. and bring those two together, I think we're much more of a complete person. And yeah, the corpus callosum acts as the highway in the brain between those, as far as we know, between right. the parts of the brain. And as we're able to connect those two together, I think then you see amazing talents manifested. That's why I think some of our greatest works of music, I think they kind of bring those two together. Somebody like Beethoven or somebody like that, you know, bring like the mathematical, you know, of the symphony versus the emotion, kind of bring the two together.
And would you also say that that's kind of merging the masculine and feminine energy as well?
Yeah, I would imagine so. Somehow it's a bringing two together, kind of make us more of a complete full person rather than kind of fractured or dysfunction, kind of bringing us to.
So what I hear you saying, I think, is that below all of this or these distractions we have, that there's actually a fully integrated being that we aren't necessarily all that aware of yet.
Yeah, I think we are very much not as self-aware as we should be. And I think when we learn to become in tune to that spiritual side, or who we truly are, you know, from the universe perspective, who we are as beings, that then we also start to live our lives differently. I think we try to live more positively and try to remember that connection with others. And I think that we limit ourselves. Plus, I think we're limited just being physically in the you know, mortal world that we live in. That we live in this finite world, but the universe is not finite. It's an infinite universe. And trying to understand the infinite from a finite perspective is difficult.
Great word. Right. It is difficult. Now, what's interesting though is, again, comparing philosophies, religions, and things, looking for that golden thread. As we know, one of the, I don't know, if baseline philosophies, I guess, of the church is that we're gods and goddesses in embryo, right? And that fits to the, you know, the old scriptural reference of we're sons and daughters of God. Okay, so what are we when we grow up? And this is a conversation and questions we don't necessarily ask all that much, because we are told that it's blasphemous and we should never do that. Well, why not, right? If this is so, and we have this capacity, it goes back thousands of years in the Vedantic philosophy. That philosophy is based around this unity consciousness that we're all a part of, and individuated threads of as God incarnate. And that's 10,000-15,000 years old. And we're just now coming to that understanding in modern religions. Seems kind of, right? The last couple hundred years anyway. Tremendous progress we've made.
Yeah.
Right. So how do we, and you understand how congruent those two things are, right? There's a belief, there's a dogma of many religions that include that same philosophy, and yet when people start manifesting the example of it, they're ostracized. Why is that?
I think,
would you agree, first of all, and then what, because I don't want to just make an assumption without.
No, I agree that we are definitely a higher purpose, that there's a God in the universe, and that they God or goddess, you know, a heavenly father and heavenly mother, you know.
I call it the thoughtmosphere, right? There's this infinite intelligence that's this magnificent, unqualified thoughtmosphere, and our choices help to manifest whatever it is we need to experience.
Yes, and as we go through life and we realize that we're connected, that we have this higher purpose, I think it changes the way we live our lives, that we don't just try to live the day by day, but we try to do what, quote, the right thing. We talk about that in our conscience. We try to do the right thing, not just because it'll make our lives better, but just because it's the right thing to do, you know?
Well, intrinsically, like we were talking earlier, there's that knowing, there's that conscience that's resident, that when we do the right thing, and even when nobody's looking, we know. Yeah. How can we look in the mirror knowing and then feel comfortable about how we are? It would seem to me that that would really cause some major confusion internally, and the, you know, and that quest that eventually leads to a place like you and I have experienced, where we come to a place that's so traumatic that we have to start questioning ourselves and letting go of what we assumed to be true.
Yes, and being honest with ourselves, that internal honesty is a very difficult thing for people to go through, to be truly honest with yourself. Say, you know, I have issues, you know, it's okay. You know, I have these things. It's okay. That's who I am, you know, but I can work through them and become even stronger after I go through these, you know, experiences. Mm-hmm. And be fully, become self-aware and be aware of how those, you know, feelings and emotions affect us and those flaws, and try to then see what's the higher purpose in life? You know, why are we here? You know, is it just to make money or whatever, goods or whatever, or is it to create a, try to leave the world a little bit better than
how about share a planet?
Yes.
And learn how to work together to do so that we're all safe and secure.
Exactly. Rather than trying to be selfish, more selfless, you know, try to
It would seem, innocent bystander, right, observing things, it would seem that if there is this natural order in the universe that we see, and it's all working perfectly, right? There's no anomalies. For us to think there are one, there is an anomaly, usually means we don't quite understand things well enough yet. And so in being able to bring that understanding back to this natural evolutionary process, wouldn't it just make sense that this is part of this internal programming that's at the base of everyone to love and be loved and learn how to work together in order for that to manifest fully? Is that possible? Yeah,
I think that every human being is born with that internal want to be able to love and to love others. And the idea that we're all born with that thing, and you're interesting, the thought of like we're God's an embryo. I think that we're just, that this mortal existence is just a pathway, a short-term school per se, to help us to grow, to become more selfless, to be better, as in the to become more perfected with the universe, you know, being able to coexist, like you said, on a planet, to share, to be able to be, you know, in harmony, be able to be connect with people. It's a process that we grow through, and I think as we go through this life, it can either make us better that way, or we can become more bitter and more victimized, and we progress. And through this school, I think this life's like a school here.
Yeah, I would agree. And how do we all graduate with honors, right? That's the question. And
help that's the question.
So as well, because it's, you know, unless we do, then we're really not fully participating, because there is that self-driven, you know, last century precursive, right? It's almost a masculine energy of the drive to acquire that has devastated our planet and the people on it because of the profit over people and planet agenda that's been present. Not that it was a bad thing initially, however, it's grown to the point that where there hasn't really been good management of it. Now, how do we fix that? What do you think we can do to help resolve this disparity and learn how to work together more in the capacity that we're capable of?
I think the first thing has to start with us individually. It has to start with one person, meaning the one person we can most affect is ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll start with us individually. And then once we try to make good decisions for ourselves that kind of are positive, then on a daily basis, working, just trying to make one positive, you know, influence in the world on it, you know, just trying to change, as we change our little sphere of influence around us, and we try to, then that spreads, that energy, the positive energy spreads out across the world. Not just, so one person then changes by the ripple effect, can changes. If you pay it forward, meaning you do something nice for one person that day, then there's a chance they'll do something nice for somebody, or positive for something else. And as that spreads positively, rather than saying like the opposite, we spread negativity, as you said, kind of the selfishness versus selflessness.
So what do you say to the materialist that doesn't believe in any of this and still wants to go after their own self-interests? What can we, you and I, because we're both in the same boat, I think, and it's rising with the tide, right? And how do we address that? How do we invite curiosity or exploration or questioning of the seeming reality that they're experiencing?
Well, I think this materialism or consumerism is, they'll never be fulfilled. They'll never have that emptiness filled. You can buy as much stuff as you want, but you'll never have that empty place in your heart be filled, because goods and things like that never fill us completely. But as we try to do good or serve or share with others, I think then we actually feel. A good example is somebody like Mother Teresa, right? Mother Teresa, you know, monetarily, temporally, she had very little, but she seemed to be one of the most happy, fulfilled persons to live, because she was
and
out.
What an impact.
Yeah. Right?
What you an know, she, impact.
She impacted millions just by, you know, this trying to do good and things and trying to be selfless and help others and not take it in. And because those people who seek for just materialism and goods and things like that, that will never fill that place that you can't, that place that's missing. It will never fill. And I think one question I ask those people as they look for that, just ask, you know, are you happy? Or do you feel fulfilled, you know, buying whatever, the Ferrari, the Lamborghini, whatever, you know, does that fulfill you? It might for a short time, but then it loses its kind of luster. It loses its, you know, brilliance, and then you have to look for something else and keep searching. They're searching and searching, and it will never fill that place until you learn to kind of leave that a little bit behind, I think, and start to serve others, to kind of have that help, the connection to lift, you know. And like I said, like Mother Teresa, I think for me is a perfect example.
Absolutely. And so what I hear you saying is that life becomes more cooperative and collaborative than competitive.
Exactly. We rise above the whole idea of competition. Now, competition can be healthy in some ways. Obviously, it creates, you know, innovation and things like that. It's great, but it can be taken to an excess. You know, everything can be taken too far.
Right. Not win above all, right?
It's, exactly.
We've got to be, you know, I like to call it a triple win. A win for you, a win for me, and a win for the planet. Because those three, we are, whether we realize it or not, of the earth. Every single cell in our body comes from the earth.
Yeah, we're all carbon-based life forms. We're all, right. You know.
And well, in the food that we take in, that this is what, you know, where's it come from? Well, it's comes from the earth in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, and in other ways, you know, what's the earth? Well, it's kind of collected stardust. And so are we then stardust? And, you know, this is what Dr. Lazo kind of talks about, is there's this higher self that then from the Vedantic place permeates reality. And it's just our ability to acquiesce to this energy, this understanding, this connectedness that's deep within us. And apparently from recent scientific discoveries, there's a bridge between the inner and the outer worlds, which we live half inside and half outside. Most of it, we're kind of bereft of the inner, which is what we're talking about and why we're talking about it, is to help bolster that understanding and willingness to be vulnerable and explore it without so much fear, right? So in that ultimate coming up, there's a genetic as well as a vibrational coherence in our bodies of the coding and the frequency and that conscience that is active and guiding us toward something, right? And that being individuated, it's going to be different for everybody. We're like snowflakes, all right? However, this hierarchical structure, for lack of a better, is meant to work in harmony. So why not ask questions about it from a place of exploring how it might be in harmony already, and then emulating that as humans? This is something that, do you feel that this is, that you're seeing this beginning to happen, and that what you've discovered from your medical training and the exploration of consciousness in that, as well as your religious studies, does this seem to edify the growth of humanity in some respects?
I think it does. And I think a lot of times people think science and religion are opposed, but in reality, they're both seeking truth. They're both seeking the truth. And I think if we start to kind of marriage the two together, that science and religion are not necessarily opposed, they can be synergistic. They can come together and understand the world better. You can't.
And I would think if they don't prove each other, then they're both questionable.
Exactly. And then they should prove each other's together. You know, they should come together and create understanding of the universe, because neither, you know, they are cohesive. They don't necessarily have to be competitive. They can be cohesive and work together. And as we start to kind of approach science with a, you know, some type of spirituality with it, I think our understanding grows better, because one example I think of, like Chinese medicine, I've been learning a little more about Chinese medicine and kind of things like that. And
fascinating. The daytones.
It is.
And the meridians.
Meridians and acupuncture and all these things, and kind of the herbs and things like that. You talk about coming from the earth. Some of the Chinese medicines actually work very well, you know, just herbs and things like that from the earth. And the idea that, and that doesn't oppose modern American medicine either. I mean, there's no reason why we can't use the two together to create the strengths of both, you know.
Oh, Big Pharma wouldn't like that though, right?
Yeah, there is a...
And that's... You know, this is the elephant in the room, right? It's about making money. It's not about health. It's about disease and just creating it, the symptoms and the cures, or the, well, you know what I mean. There's this prescriptive quality that we have about life that, oh, you're feeling that way, well, take this, right?
Yeah.
How that would be good.
Yeah, and I think they both have strengths. You know, obviously some of the medications, stuff like that, are very light.
Absolutely agree with that. However,
and then putting the two together, the idea of, you know, sometimes profit, you know, is, as we all know, sometimes profit over patients is not, it's obviously not a good thing.
And we've created a nation of addicts with the oxycodone epidemic and things like that.
Yeah, and instead of, I think as people use other things like massage therapy and things like that to deal with their chronic pain, they're much better served, and there's not a risk of addiction or things like that. As we, you know, it's the whole, opioid addiction is a terrible epidemic right now in the U.S.
And unfortunately, insurance doesn't cover massage or many alternative health therapies and things of that nature, which is kind of odd and very telling of how the two industries could be working together. I'm not saying they do, right? But there's.
But they could be, yes. Yeah, I go to massage therapy myself, you know, like, and I found it's been incredibly, I had some carpal tunnel symptoms in my arms from, you know, my job, and doing massage therapy really has helped me that I didn't have to have surgery, you know, really got me through that, you know, and helped kind of some of these issues like that. And, you know, other therapies like acupuncture, you know, my wife does acupuncture now, and it's been very helpful for a lot of, you know, things that she's been, you know, going through, just these other ideas that there's good reason. There's a reason why Chinese medicine's been around for thousands of years. You know, they've worked on these things too.
And those needles are not just to go in specific places. They're actually using your body's own electromagnetic field to feed you the energy back where it needs to be in order to open the flow up. That's what I find so fascinating. Right? 5,000 years old or thereabouts, this kind of, you know, what would I call it? psycho-spiritual technology, maybe?
Yeah, the idea that we're not just organic beings, that we actually have this energy or spiritual side too, I think is we try to explore that more and realize that we're not just carbon-based life forms, but we're something higher to us. There's something more to us.
What was fascinating to me in my conversation with Dr. Laszlo is coming from, you know, perspective of quantum physics and the at least awareness that we're 99% space and 1% material. And when I mentioned that, Dr. Laszlo said, I would offer that we are 100% energy. Because now from a quantum perspective, there is no physicality. There's vibrating squigglies, right? That come together to manifest everything. And depending on our own perception or our belief or our awareness or our projection of what we anticipate a world to look like based on what we've experienced so far, right? We get programmed to anticipate or expect certain things. What happens when that gets shattered and that we have an experience that shows that, oh, things are really super connected in, and so much so that we can't fathom just how much so until this inexplicable event happens that edifies that particular perspective, right? What have you had in your life that's done that? Because I know you have.
So I have, yeah. So when my father passed away in 2006, and he was in Utah and I was in Pennsylvania or Maryland, so 2,000 miles away, literally 2,000 miles separation of space. But when he passed away that night, I woke up from my sleep and I knew that he was gone. And literally 15 seconds later, my mom called on the phone. My mother called to tell me that he'd passed away, or 30 seconds later. But I just had this connection that I knew that he was gone, even though I was 2,000 miles away from him. I can't explain it, you know, physically or more, but I just knew that I had this connection that he was gone. He passed from this world. Mm-hmm. And it's an experience like that that kind of you realize there's a lot more than we even comprehend of how we're connected with, especially family and friends, and how we are connected. And that I can't explain it. I just know that I woke up and I knew he was gone. I just knew. It's I don't know how to explain it, but you know.
I know it's hard to explain, and because there's so many integrated features in how you, the two of you, one being the bloodline, the frequency, all of those, you know, really finely discerning instances in the differences, slight difference rather than deviance in your physical frequency, right? And your bloodline, right? So you're connected. It's like the cultural memories that we have from our distant relatives are still present in our physical forms because of that genetic engineering factor, right? That we carry those. And then we wonder in some cases why certain patterns show up as triggers. Are they personal or are they historic?
Yeah, right? They could be both.
Exactly. So, and these are some of the things that we don't necessarily consider, especially when we're dealing with stuff and we've got the more materialistic mindset about it. Right? It's got to be something wrong with me. Well, what if it's just something right with you that you haven't fully understood yet?
Yeah.
Speaking of being something right, you know, we've probably coming up close to our allotted time. And I'm so appreciative of this conversation. It's been wonderful. What kind of offering, is there something that you would like to share with the audience or a tasty tidbit of a daily practice that you might suggest for them to explore and find out about this difference for themselves?
Yeah, so one thing I do now, I live in Florida by the beach. And so on a daily basis, my wife and I try to go and walk along the sand on the beach and be connected with, you know, the world and just feel the energy of, you know, the ocean and the breeze and touch the sand with our feet and kind of being grounded in the earth. And I think to take a daily, just on a daily basis, try to go outside and explore and just be connected with the world, you know, take your shoes off, touch the ground, feel the ground, you know, just be connected to realize that we're all part of this world together, that just 5-10 minutes a day, just go outside and just be a part of the world, be connected, feel the sunlight, feel the rain, feel the air, feel, and just be here, part of the world, and realize that we're all part of this world together. I think as we do that, we'll realize that, you know, that's okay, that person cut me off in traffic, I can let it go, you know, it's, right, you know, right. It's just maybe they have some reason, you know, we learn to let these things go more, you know, just to kind of be that we're all here together, you know, that we're all here on this planet together, and we're all connected.
And doesn't matter what your profession is, the earth's the same.
Yeah. You know, I can walk along the beach here in Florida or walk along the beach in Hawaii. It's the same thing, you know?
Yeah, well, here in Arizona, there's no ocean, just beach.
Just the sand. But.
Right. Oh, well, Chris, I really thank you for this conversation. I know, having gone through some of the similar things that you have, there's a wonderful vulnerability that you have to be able to talk about this. And I appreciate that. And
yes,
I'm sure
well, thank our
audience
you.
Does as well. And hopefully they will, you know, take some nuggets and apply them to themselves and grow accordingly.
Well, thank you. It's been wonderful. I've really enjoyed this deep conversation. It's been fabulous. It's been fascinating. So.
For me too. And thank you so much again, Chris. And namaste. And in La Ketch, and thank you for sticking with us for this episode of One World in a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I'll see you next time.